Texas cattle ranchers are keeping their eyes on President Trump's plans for NAFTA. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. On the campaign trail, then-candidate Trump called the North American Free Trade Agreement a disaster and promised to pull out of it unless Mexico agreed to revisions in America's favor. But now President Trump appears to be taking a more cautious approach. Mexican officials say their country will retaliate against any new trade restrictions. U.S. beef exports to our southern neighbor skyrocketed when NAFTA phased out tariffs. Cattle industry representatives warn reopening the treaty would put those gains in jeopardy. But as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, some longtime ranchers caught in the middle are optimistic because the president is a businessman.
My name is Coleman Locke, and I'm from Hungerford, Texas. Our family ranch is J.D. Hudgens Incorporated. And we have been in business since 1908.
Locke says Mexico has long been one of the most important foreign markets for J.D. Hudgens. The family ranch sells Brahman cattle south. Mexican ranchers breed them with their own stock, then sell the calves back to the U.S.
Those feeder cattle that came into Texas are, by and large, owned by Texans or somebody here in the United States. So the profit on those animals will be made in this country.
Feeder cattle, that is, cattle that are raised to be slaughtered for beef, Texas's top agricultural export. And the largest foreign buyer of Texas beef? Mexico.
Since NAFTA was created, the export for beef to Mexico has grown by 750%.
To get a sense of why, we spoke with another rancher.
My name is Kelly Sullivan, and I am co-owner of Santa Rosa Ranch.
Sullivan's family, too, has been in the beef industry for more than a century. They now raise Brangus and Ultra Black cattle at locations in Houston County and Grimes County.
The export market is very, very important to us, so we keep an eye on it. Prior to, for example, NAFTA being passed, there was a 25% tariff on our beef.
We asked both Sullivan and Locke if they were concerned about the potential for trade disputes between the U.S. and Mexico to hurt their businesses.
I personally, and I think most producers do, feel hopeful in the fact because what we do know is that President Trump is a businessman and understands the importance of having markets available for products.
I'm confident that the Trump team will negotiate trade deals which will be beneficial to our beef industry, and I feel confident that he will have our beef organizations at the bargaining table. And we'll be taking advice from them.
The National Cattlemen's Beef Association is the industry's lead trade organization and is in the thick of those talks. Kent Backus is the group's director of international trade.
Quite frankly, we're worried that if there are any significant changes that are made to NAFTA, it could jeopardize our ability to remain competitive.
Trump has already dealt beef producers a blow by pulling America out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The trade agreement would have lowered barriers to Japan, a market even more important to the industry than Mexico.
Last year, we sold $1.5 billion worth of U.S. beef to Japanese consumers, but we sold it with a 38.5% tariff tacked onto the end of it. Meanwhile, our competitors, the Australians, have about a 10 to 11% tariff rate advantage over us. And as a result, we've been losing about $400,000 per day in potential sales. Well, TPP would have eliminated that gap on day one.
Backus is lobbying hard to make sure the administration understands what's at stake with NAFTA, because if that trade agreement unravels, his members will be among the first hurt.
Beef has traditionally been a target for many retaliatory efforts when it comes to trade. And Mexico has made that threat before. We can't take these threats lightly.
The Commerce Department is expected to notify Congress shortly of the administration's intent to renegotiate NAFTA. Once it does, talks will begin within 90 days. I'm Andrew Schneider.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he'll withhold federal grants to cities that don't follow federal rules on immigration enforcement. Santa Fe, New Mexico Mayor Javier Gonzalez is an outspoken critic of the Trump administration's stance on immigration. He told KUNM's Ed Williams he won't be changing the city's openly immigrant-friendly policy.
you know, we don't believe that this will have an impact on any Department of Justice grants on Santa Fe, because we believe that we are fully compliant with all federal laws and all state laws. Having said that, we're not going to change our policies of welcoming immigrants from around the world, especially those that want to come in and contribute to the well-being of our community. And unfortunately, this has really been played out more on the political stage as theater, but has had a real devastating impact in the homes in our community. Many children go to school worried about whether their parents will be home at night, and many parents go to work hoping that they'll get to return home to see their children.
When we're talking about immigrants that could be impacted by these policies, or that you're saying already are feeling an impact from these policies, who are we talking about?
Well, here in Santa Fe, 14% of our population is part of the immigrant community. Because we don't ask for status, we don't know how many have documentation and how many don't. But it's a large segment of our population, whether you have documentation or you don't, whether you're an employer, whether you're a school teacher. It is a difficult environment for people to wake up to every day.
You said Santa Fe is following federal immigration rules. Attorney General Sessions said he would withhold funds from cities that don't share information with immigration enforcement. So are you sharing information with federal immigration officers now?
You know, let's make clear that there is no constitutional requirement by the federal constitution that requires cities to participate in the enforcement of federal immigration policy. There's nothing that compels cities to have to participate in an area that clearly is within the realm of the federal government. The rule that General Sessions points to as a rule that requires local governments to share information, we are in compliance with that. What our city does not do is that we don't collect status on people who live in our community. So there's not a collection of information on any of our citizens. The federal government's welcome to any information, just like the public is welcome to on any data that the city is currently in charge of.
So the city is in compliance because it's sharing information. It's just not collecting the information that that Attorney General Sessions is talking about.
That's correct. We don't. There's nowhere in city government that we collect information regarding the status of a person living in our city.
The city of Santa Fe signed on to a friend of the court brief in support of a lawsuit by a county in California that's challenging the Trump administration's policies on sanctuary cities. Is a lawsuit specifically from the city of Santa Fe a possibility going forward in your view?
No, because I think that with the presence of these lawsuits, being able to join in on an amicus allows us to lend our support, to let the courts know that there is an impact in our community, and to participate in trying to get a preemption on a policy that is flawed, that doesn't achieve the objective of protecting our country, and is incredibly vague. And that has certainly been the pattern under this president, and we're hoping that the courts will do what they did, as they did in the travel ban, and they will say that this policy is not lawful.
That was KUNM's Ed Williams speaking with Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested more than 150 people in South and Central Texas during the last 2 weeks. ICE reports the majority of the foreign nationals taken into custody are Mexican residents and had criminal convictions. The rest are from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Canada. Waiting in line for a chance to become a U.S. citizen is easier said than done. Immigration experts say for some, there's no line, but for others, the wait could outlast a lifetime, as long as 160 years. KUT's Joy Diaz explains.
So, when someone like former Texas Governor Rick Perry says,
if you want to be a citizen, go get in the line and pay the dues and pay the time, just like everybody else has done that came before you.
It really begs the question, where is this line? Michelle Waslin is with a policy research organization based in Washington, D.C., called the American Immigration Council.
So there is this very common myth that people in foreign countries can simply get in line. This is really not the fact. There are many people for whom there is just no immigration line.
Not a single line for some, but as many as three for others. The first one?
Let's look at the family immigration system.
Okay, that's where U.S. citizens and green card holders can apply for visas for close family members, such as their kids, spouse, or siblings. The second line is for jobs.
Employers in the U.S. can petition for workers to come to the United States, but there are limited categories of workers that can be admitted.
This is the line where the Googles of the country wait to fill in vacancies. Also standing in that line are construction companies and nanny services. Every year, the U.S. awards 5,000 visas to unskilled workers. But of course, that's vastly insufficient. Any large city in Texas alone employs more than 5,000 unskilled immigrant workers between nannies, cooks, and tree trimmers. The third line is for refugees. And that's it.
A person outside the country can't just sign up on some line, get in line for a visa.
If that's all there is, if there are no other lines, then perhaps our rhetoric needs to change. But while we're on the topic, I wonder what happens to the lucky few who are able to get into one of the three lines that do exist. Well, they wait and wait, often as though trapped in a bizarre dream where they're in line with millions and the line hardly ever moves. Immigration expert Kate Lincoln Goldfinch says that's not an exaggeration.
The way that we gauge how long someone in a particular category might have to wait is by looking at how backlogged that category is and then gauging the rate of speed that it advanced in the previous year.
To give an example, let's say immigration is currently reviewing visa applications submitted back in, say, March of 1996. And a year ago, they reviewed applications from just a month prior, February of 1996.
What that tells you is that the category advanced forward only 30 days. And so siblings of United States citizens who are from Mexico are currently more than 20 years backlogged, but they're moving at such a slow rate of speed that it could take 160 years for that category to become current, which, needless to say, is longer than a lifetime.
More than 160 years? And still, people continue getting in line. Recently, it was J. Carmen Avila Flores who stood at the very back on behalf of his 26-year-old sister. She's young, he says. That's one of the reasons we decided to apply. He says even if it takes 40 years, well, that time will go by anyway. Might as well get her visa in the end. But what if the end is not 40 years into the future, but 160? Food for thought. For Fronteras, I'm Joy Diaz.
Coming up on Fronteras, many entertainers have taken a stage name, but not Texas comedian Aaron Arianpour, whose father migrated from Iran.
Growing up here, I was always made to feel like I had to answer for my last name.
We'll explore the story of his success after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Comic Aaron Arianpour has toured, been on TV, and become a mainstay in the Texas comedy scene. He was voted Best Comic in Texas in 2012 and recently headlined the Dallas Comedy Festival. The son of an Iranian immigrant, Arianpour made a point of keeping his last name professionally. He says his inspiration for comedy came from seeing George Carlin and Gary Shandling on stage. That stage is where Aaron wanted to be and where KERA's Jerome Weeks caught up with him.
We're at the Backdoor Comedy Club in Dallas.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the incomparable Aaron Arianpour.
Thank you. That's great. A lot of you looking at me like you don't know who the hell I am. That's fine. If you've seen America's Got Talent, if you've seen Last Comic Standing, if you've seen The Tonight Show,
I have seen all those programs as well, so we're all on the same page.
Actually, the North Texas comic has appeared on the Fox TV show, Laughs. He's toured with comic Maz Gibrani and shared a stage with Richard Lewis. He has his own album out. So Arianpour's being modest, and that suits his regular Family Guy persona. That stand-up persona is something he is and something he's created. After all, he's a guy who grew up in Denton, the son of an Iranian immigrant, and he deliberately kept Arianpour as his stage name.
Growing up here, I was always made to feel like I had to answer for my last name. Not out of any vindictiveness or anything like that, but that doesn't mean that I didn't grow up feeling like an outsider. I've had to live with this name, and I've had to explain it. I'm going to hold on to it, and I'm going to make you learn it.
The thing that's weird about stand-up is, like, the audiences will eventually tell you how they perceive you.
For more than 15 years, Paul Varghese has shared stages and tours with Arianpour. At different times, they've even been voted the funniest comic in Texas. Varghese is an Indian American with a dark complexion, which is why he says he feels he has to address race in his comedy. Arianpour has light skin. His ethnic background isn't as apparent.
It doesn't fit their physical description of somebody from Iran. So the vibe they get is the guy that lives next door. You know, it's very relatable.
Arianpour doesn't avoid ethnic issues. As he says, they're just not at the top of his mind. Not like the way his wife, Nicole, orders in restaurants, or the way their two young sons have no idea about birthday gifts for mom.
If you don't buy gifts from the kids to their mom, there's no initiative whatsoever. Preschoolers broke. I don't mind buying her the gifts. I'm just tired of coming up with the ideas. I'm out. I'm like, all right, boys, gather around. I need fresh ideas for mommy. 12-year-old, what you got? Nothing? Thanks. You, new guy. Any ideas?
Varghese says, starting out, he and other Dallas comics felt Arianpour was already the natural one on stage. But he was actually the youngest of the bunch.
I think if anything that's changed for Aaron over the years, it's his material is just better. Before, I think he was looking for observational stuff, and now that's not as important to him as talking about his family.
Off stage, the 38-year-old Arianpour is not a wisecracker needing an audience. He's thought deeply about stand-up, about things like using his family life for material.
They didn't sign on for this. My wife had married me 6 months before I even thought about doing stand-up. So I try to keep that in mind and, you know, honor that as much as I can.
Arianpour says he first got on stage because he wanted to stand where Gary Shandling and Chris Rock stood. Now the stage is the one place where he gets to play. It's where he doesn't feel self-conscious anymore. He doesn't even suck in his gut.
It takes a while to stop being a caricature of a comedian and start being yourself. And the moment you're yourself, things really start to open up for you.
4 years ago, Arianpour turned down a major job offer as an art director to focus on his comedy. He still works part-time in design, but he has steady comedy gigs, corporate events, voiceover work.
I got to work my first cruise this last fall. I guess technically that makes me a cruise ship comedian, which is not the goal.
What is the goal? Well, stardom. But Arianpour says what he'd really like to do is maybe an illustrated children's book or an animated project, something that combines his cartooning abilities, his writing, and his comedy. Comedy transforms things. It may sound trite, he says, but it's a little like the blues that way.
You take all these things in your life where you felt mistreated or all the ways that you fall short, and then you turn it into something joyous for other people to dance along to or clap to.
There is, he says, nothing better.
For Fronteras, I'm Jerome Weeks in Dallas.
The popular coming-of-age story, The House on Mango Street, makes its way back to San Antonio's Classic Theater this weekend and next. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan has the details.
It was a stage adaptation of Sandra Cisneros' House on Mango Street. The Classic Theater's Kelly Rausch says San Antonio couldn't get enough of it.
We sold out the whole run. So we worked with the cast to bring back the original cast and director.
This being the place where Mrs. Cisneros lived for so long, they felt an additional obligation to really get it right.
Oh, absolutely. We did not go into it lightly, Jose. The director is longtime friends with Sandra and was very aware of wanting to do justice.
Turns out one of the performances had a celebrity.
Sandra came and saw the show in September and wrote a beautiful note to the actors and the director and stayed afterwards and chatted with us. And she really, really liked our productions.
It's the story of a young girl just beginning to become a young woman. So to capture that transition required exceptional casting.
We were very lucky in finding Bella Villarreal. She is 11 and is really beyond her years in what she is able to do. And Sandra had said she had never seen it with such a young performer. And that made it even more moving for her because of Bella's skill.
That central character is Esperanza, hope in Spanish. Though it is drama that may not be for the entire family.
Certainly, students are reading this book in middle school and high school and college and beyond. So middle school and up.
House on Mongo Street has a two-weekend run.
Celebrate this season of hope with us with a very hopeful story.
Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
That's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.